Okay, so today's discourse seed, Majjhima 13, Chula Dukkha Kanda Sutta. It'll take a little while to get the technology. So, here's another one. This is the second one that came up on Google, the second image of suffering. So it's quite interesting, you've got these two, one very concrete and normal image of suffering, and then one extremely abstract one. And what kind of struck me when I just looked at these images very quickly, just as like a snapshot of what how people see suffering or how it's regarded, most of these images are actually from religious sites. So it seems that whatever else it may be, but suffering is still a very good PR tool for religions. Anyone know Italian? And suffering and the sovereignty of God. Of course, this being the kind of the classic problem for all of the theistic religions, if not the problem for theistic religions, is how do you reconcile the existence of a good God with the fact that there's so much suffering in the world, and either God isn't good, or suffering isn't real, or we find some other kind of explanation for it. And so here's obviously an attempt, one of a very long line of attempts to try to justify that, or try to work that out. Of course, it's not being a problem at all in Buddhism, it's being more of a Buddhist take on the matter. That's it. Okay, so that's just a few short lines to just introduce the topic for today. Okay, so this particular sutta, the Sutra on the Great Mass of Suffering, we've already had in this chapter, the second chapter in the Majjhima Nikaya, we've already had the small discourse on the lion's roar and the larger discourse on the lion's roar. And now we have the larger discourse on the mass of suffering. And the next one is the smaller discourse on the mass of suffering. And if you think you're detecting a pattern here, then of course you're quite right. And the theme of this particular chapter in the Majjhima Nikaya is to organize discourses around pairs of the greater and the lesser. Or at least that's not all, necessarily all of them, but that's one of the ways in which the suttas are organized. Now this particular sutta, as usual, has its own correlates, and the particular one has three Chinese parallels, one of which is found in the Majjhima Agama, one in the Akhotara Agama, and the third is an individual translation. So the Majjhima Agama translation, of course, being from the Sarvastivadin school, Akhotara Agama, as usual, unknown, and the individual translation, also Akhotara Agama, unknown, but probably Mahasanghika, or possibly Mahasanghika, and the individual translation, as usual, unknown. It says here, according to the information given in the Taisho edition, the individual translation was translated by an unknown translator between 25 and 220 AD. So a very early sutta. And in addition, Venerable Vinalio mentions a few, or one particular Sanskrit version, which is also quite interesting. Okay, so I'll keep the Pali text up there so that we can keep our eye on that, and if there's any words and so on that need to be pointed out, then we can do that as we go along. So it starts out, "Thus have I heard, at one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savatthi in Jetta's Grove in Atapindika's Park. And when it was morning, a number of bhikkhus dressed and taking their bowls and outer robes went into Savatthi for alms." So if you've been to visit the monastery at Savatthi in India, then the Jetta one is actually a very nice distance outside of the main town. It's a little bit closer in than we are here to Bundanoon, I think, but a similar kind of distance, so that you can go for a nice, healthy, constitutional walk in the morning to get your chapatis. Then, of course, there's no town at Savatthi itself anymore. There's some nearby towns, but the actual site is deserted. Then they thought, it is still too early to wander for alms in Savatthi. Suppose we enter the park of the wanderers of other sects. So when it says the wanderers of other sects here, is the term here, anyatithya, paribhajika. Paribhajika means those who've gone forth. Anyatithya, anya is other, tithya is like a word that's used for religions, but you know, usually other religions. So anyatithya and paribhajika. Aramo is the word that's used for a monastery here. So this is like the park. Arama literally means, the root of arama is a pleasure garden, a pleasure, it's from the root to be happy. It's quite nice, isn't it? So a monastery is a place where you should be happy. And it was like a park. So of course, mostly being jungle in those areas, so I guess they would kind of civilize the jungle a bit, clear out a bit of the jungle and make it a bit more habitable. And so this was the most common word used for the monastery in the early days. So they just wanted to go over there and have a chat with them. So they went to the park of the wanderers of other sects and exchanged greetings with them. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, they sat down on one side. So notice that they didn't say, let's go to the park of the wanderers and other sects and refute their hideous, vile, heretical doctrines. They just went over to have a chat with them. The wanderers said to them, friends, the recluse Gotama describes the full understanding of sensual pleasures, and we do so too. The recluse Gotama describes the full understanding of material form, and we do so too. The recluse Gotama describes the full understanding of feelings, and we do so too. What then is the distinction here, friends? What is the variance? What is the difference between the recluse Gotama's teaching of the Dhamma and ours, between his instructions and ours? Then those bhikkhus neither approved nor disapproved of the wanderer's words. Without doing either, they arose from their seats and went away thinking, we shall come to understand the meaning of these words in the Blessed One's presence. In the Chinese version, that's a little bit different. That in the Chinese version, I believe the wanderers went to visit the monks rather than the other way around. In the Madhyama Agama version, an individual translation, the other wanderers had come to visit the monks. So this is kind of setting up an interesting precedent or interesting manner of doing interreligious dialogue. I mean, these people have obviously, in a sense, emphasizing the commonality, so they're emphasizing what Buddhism has in common with these other religions, and they're kind of wondering about whether there is any difference or not, and if there is any difference, what is the case. So notice that's quite a nice attitude to have, that they're quite open to the fact that there are very important things in common between the different religions, but they're also they want to know. They don't come there with a presumption that, oh yes, there is no difference, or yes, there is a big difference and it's like this or like that, but they're coming there with an attitude of inquiry. So that way, of course, we can learn something. So these words down the bottom of the sutta here, nabi neva abhi nandingsu, abhi nandadin, to rejoice in it, is usually the word that's used at the end of the Buddhist discourses, where it says that the monks rejoiced in the Buddha's sayings, but they didn't. Never. Abhinandingsu. Napatikosingsu. Neither rejected it. So this is kind of a saying. So again, this is quite a nice little middle way attitude, isn't it? Neither accepting nor rejecting when we hear things that we don't know. And that takes quite a bit of mental development, actually, because normally our tendency is so much to, you know, just, yes, you instantly reject it, or you instantly say, yes, yes, that's right, or reject it. But they're like, oh, hang on, this needs further inquiry. Yeah? And again, this is a very, very nice attitude to have. It sort of sets up a context where you can learn. So then those bhikkhus, when they wandered for alms in Savatthi and had returned from their alms round after the meal, they went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told him what had taken place. Bhikkhus, wanderers of other sects who speak thus, should be questioned thus. But friends, what is the gratification? What is the danger? And I feel like the questioner on the bridge in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, who's asking the questions three. What is your name? What is your quest? What is the average in-flight speed of a swallow? Okay, what is the gratification? What is the danger? And what is the escape in the case of sensual pleasures? What is the danger? Gratification, what is the danger? And what is the escape in the case of material form? What is the gratification? What is the danger? And what is the escape in the case of feelings? Being questioned thus, the wanderers of other sects will fail to account for the matter, and then what is more, they will get into difficulties. Why is that? Because it is not in their, not their province. Because I see no one in the world with its devas, its maras, and its brahmas, in this generation with its samanas and brahmans, with its princes and its people, who could satisfy the mind with a reply to these questions, except for the Tathagata, or his disciple, or one who has learned it from them. So, there's quite a lion's roar there by the Buddha. This passage being the same in all of the suttas. And here are the words here. The asada, what is the of sensual pleasures? So we have karma. Kamana, asado is the gratification, sometimes translated as the sweet taste, the pleasure, what's sucking you into them? What's pulling you in? What's getting you involved? What's not letting you let go of those things? What is the danger? Adinava, okay, and nisarana is the escape. Nisarana is actually the negative form of sarana. So we know sarana as in buddhang saranang gacchami, king nisaranang, without refuge, a escape. So what is the, and regarding forms, rupanang, what is the gratification, the danger, and the escape, and what regarding feelings is the gratification, the danger, and escape. Okay, so this is not within their scope, and this is a nice word, yathātaṁ bhikkhave avisayasmin, without, not in their visaya, is like the range or the scope. Okay, so the Buddha then goes on, having given that basic statement, the Buddha then goes on to talk about each of these ones in more detail. And what, because is the gratification in the case of sensual pleasures? Because there are these five chords of sensual pleasures. So the word is translated as chords of sensual pleasure is guna. Guna is translated as chord, although that particular rendering of guna is actually quite unusual and is derived really from the Pali commentaries. It doesn't seem to be found or known in the northern traditions. Guna normally means a quality of something. So this would be like the five qualities or the five kinds, simply the five kinds of sensual pleasures. The idea of it as being a chord is more like it's kind of reading the idea of ties and bondage into the, but it's not necessarily what the word itself normally means. What are the five? Forms cognizable by the eye that are wished for, desirable, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. These are the five chords of sensual pleasure. Now the pleasure and joy that arise dependent on these five chords of sensual pleasure are the gratification in the case of sensual pleasures. All right, so here, notice the very careful the way that the Buddha phrases things. Jakuvinyaya rupa. So the rupas, which means, he means sights, which are to be cognized. Vinyaya means cognizable or to be cognized by the eye. Jakuvinyaya rupa. That's actually the object of the sentence, or the subject of the sentence. So like the direct answer to this question, what are the five karma gunas, is rupa is one of the five karma gunas, okay, which is cognizable by the eye and is delightful, pleasurable, and so on. Pya rupa karma pasanhita rajaniya. So in a way it's giving you the actual answer to the question is what is that? What is that? That called a sensual pleasure is the rupa, is the see, the visible thing, but it's also the giving you the, so that's the, if you like, the denotation of it. But the connotation of it is that that rupa is delightful, pleasing, and so on and so forth, desirable, and all of those things. So this is, it's not, this is like straddling, this definition is straddling between the objective and subjective meanings of karma, karma meaning sensuality in general, but sometimes meaning the external object of sensuality, and sometimes meaning one's inner desire and attachment for them. And this particular answer seems to me to very nicely straddle that divide, the literal answer to it is the external object of which is simulating the response of desire, but it also the very fact that it's bound up in that kind of web is what makes it the karma guna, the quality of the sensuality. Does that make sense? So notice that here is only counted the five external senses, not the internal sense of the mind. So these, so whatever paticca upajati arises dependent on these sukhang somanasang, usually sukhang being physical pleasure or mental pleasure, this is the gratification of these things. So the Buddha was never denied that you can get pleasure from these things, and he never denied it. But he's just pointing out, well, how do you actually understand this? Well, how do you see the context of it? This is what it is. And so we all know what that feels like. We've all experienced sensual pleasure in many different ways. And, of course, one of the qualities of the nature of sensual pleasure is that it's always coming up in fresh forms. It's always appearing in different ways. But the actual thing itself is remains very similar, or it's just like variations on a theme. And so it's very much like our world of consumerism, where we're constantly being sold new things and new brands and new everything is always appearing in the marketplace. I always rejoice in things like toothbrushes. To me, this is just like wonderful. It's like, it seems like every year there's this new innovation in toothbrush design, you know. And there must be millions of dollars spent on these things, designing the handle and the particular material of the rubber inlays, and how do you actually shape. But they just they just clean your teeth exactly the same as they did when I was growing up as a boy. It's all the same. Cleaning your teeth is the same. And no toothbrush ever cleans your teeth as well as toothwoods do. If you have some good toothwoods from Thailand, then your teeth get much cleaner and much nicer than using any kind of toothbrush. And so you're constantly being kind of sold these things as if you've got a date strip that's got to tell you when it's worn out, you know, it's like. And so this is the nature of sensual pleasures. Any questions on that?
I do have a question on the previous one. It mentions except for one person and any disciple of that person.
Uh-huh.
Who was that person?
The Tathagata. Yeah. The Tathagata is the it's a name for the Buddha.
Oh, so he's saying the only person who could is myself or anyone.
Is anyone similarly enlightened? And he's, Tathagata is usually the word that the Buddha uses to describe himself, to refer to himself in the first person. It means, literally meaning of it is one who has arrived at, someone who has arrived at the truth, or someone who embodies the truth.
What about if you get someone like a fundamentalist Christian, mm-hmm. and I just tell you that we just believe in Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of an answer can you give to that? You can't really.
Which Jesus do you believe in, for a start?
Their Jesus.
Their Jesus. The one who says, give away all your possessions. And if it and the one who, you don't...
Pray constantly, give away everything, yeah.
Wander around barefoot and begging from home, place to place.
No, that one's never mentioned.
The one who says, oh, turn the other cheek. And
that one. And get vengeance and...
Yeah, funny that one. Yeah, I've tried to find that one in the Bible. I must have been remiss.
Names of Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very difficult because you can't use logic with people like that.
No. That's really boring. Yeah. Trying to use. I mean, you can use it just for a while, just to bait them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just kind of fun. But after a while, it gets very boring. Yeah.
That in itself is a sensual attachment.
It is. Absolutely, James, you're right. And it's very unwholesome. It's much better just to call the police and complain about them. It's much more compassionate.
I noticed that the bhikkhus move away and sat at one side.
Uh-huh.
So that would probably work too.
That would, yeah. Yeah.
Having spoken to that, I notice that often the bhikkhus sit to one side.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Does that have any significance?
Other than
in the front or up the back or?
Yeah, it's obviously an idiom. It seems to mean to sit down at a respectful distance, a respectful place. Neither too close nor too far. It's obviously just very idiomatic, but. It perhaps also, by saying sitting to one side, perhaps it was felt that by sitting like directly in front was a bit confrontational.
Like in your face.
Yeah, a bit in your face, yeah. I'm not quite sure.
What about the right side thing?
Which right side thing?
Putting
the shoulder. Yeah, maybe somewhere where your right side would be. Difficult. Yeah, could be. Yeah, look, I'm not sure exactly where that's really defined as such, but it's always just constantly used as that kind of idiom for in polite way of doing things. Hmm. Now, what, bhikkhus, is the danger in the case of sensual pleasures? Here, bhikkhus, on account of the craft by which a clansman makes a living, whether by checking or accounting. What's checking? Mudaya, or accounting, gananaya. We were talking about this yesterday, that with Bhante Bobcat, gananaya is still the word for counting in Bengali or in Indic languages, and gananaya is the word for accounting. An accountant is a gananaya. That's how I feel, as in my role as a secretary. I feel like I'm a gananaya because I'm always saying I'm going to do it. Right. Checking or counting, or calculating, is a similar kind of word, sankarena, sankhaya. Or farming, vanijaya. Or gorakhena, literally looking after the cows, translated husbandry. Or archery, isatena. Or royal service, public service, or rajapurisena. So whatever trade or craft that you have. He has to face cold, he has to face heat, he is injured by contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, sun and creeping things. He risks death by hunger and thirst. Now this is a danger in the case of sensual pleasures, a mass of suffering visible here and now. So a mass of suffering, sandirtiko, visible here and now, okay? So notice this word sandirtiko that we use in our chanting for the recollection of the Dhamma, sandirtiko. So this is not only the Dhamma is visible here and now, but also suffering is also visible here and now. Having sensual pleasures as its cause, sensual pleasures as its source, sensual pleasures as its basis, the cause being simply sensual pleasures. If no property comes to the clansman while he works and strives and makes an effort, thus he sorrows, grieves and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught, crying, "My work is in vain, my effort is fruitless." Now this too is a danger in the case of sensual pleasures, the cause being simply sensual pleasures. If property comes to the clansman while he works and strives and makes an effort, thus he experiences pain and grief in protecting it. How shall neither kings nor thieves, I love that little phrase, putting those two together in that kind of way. Neither kings nor thieves. they have, yeah, make all lawyers and things, perhaps.
Repetition, isn't
it? Yeah, that's right.
May I ask a question at this time?
Yeah, go on.
How can there be suffering in the here and now? I don't understand.
How can there be suffering in the here and now?
Surely, suffering always occurs in the past or future. It can never occur in the here and now.
Oh, yeah, suffering occurs in the here and now.
I might make a suggestion that it is only in the here and now, that the now that was gone is the past and the now that's coming is the future.
That you suffer them. You only suffer
the other way. Suffering is only here and now.
You only suffer the past and the future when in the here and now.
You only lament over the past or brood over the future, yeah, in the here and now.
Yeah. Having said which, that word translating here and now is actually a bit misleading. What it really means is in this very life. That's what it really means. Yeah. So you can translate, you can understand it in a more specific sense if you want, but more specifically, it actually means in this very life. So it's talking about, so in other places it would translate, it contrast that word we saw, sandittiko, this contrast with another word, sandittiko, translates with another word, samparayiko, where samparayiko refers to in future lives. So this is the kind of suffering which you get in this very life, as opposed to, say, the suffering you might experience in your next rebirth. Okay, so sochati kilamati paridevati uratthaling kandati. He wails, grieves, and laments, beating his breast, and falls into confusion. Yampi mehosi tampi no nati. Whatever I had before, that I do not have. Oh, very nice. So, how can kings nor thieves make off with my property, nor fire burn it, nor water sweep it away, nor hateful heirs make off with it? Interesting. And as he guards and protects his property, kings or thieves, they make off with it anyway. Or fire burns it, water sweeps it away, and hateful heirs make off with it. And when he says, more likely you spend it all in the insurance company before you actually any of those things happen. And he sorrows, grieves, and laments. He weeps, beating his breast, and becomes distraught, crying, "What I had, I have no longer." Okay, so it's building up here, getting more and more intense. The next one, again, with sensual pleasures as the cause, sensual pleasures as the source, sensual pleasures as the basis, the cause being simply sensual pleasures, kings quarrel with kings, nobles with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householders, mother quarrels with child, child with mother, father with child with father, brother quarrels with brother with sister with brother, friend with friend. And here in their quarrels, brawls, and disputes, they attack each other with fists, clods, knives, or sticks, whereby sticks, of course, being the danda. Hang up here, where's the danda? Ledupi upakamati. Dandehipi is the danda, attacking each other. So for those of you who don't get it, this is an in-house joke, don't worry about it. Whereby they incur death or deadly suffering. This too is a danger in the case of sensual pleasures, the cause being simply sensual pleasures. So I'll just read here Venerable Analia's comment on this particular passage. The Majjhima Agama version and the individual translation present this danger in two consecutive steps. First, they describe how members of a family may get into dispute with each other, followed by treating the arising of quarrelling among kings, Brahmins, and warriors. Only in relation to the second group, that is, kings, Brahmins, and warriors, do the two Chinese versions envisage the possibility that such a quarrel could lead to taking up of weapons and even to killing. Presentation in the Chinese versions receives support from the Sanskrit fragments of the Mahalla Sutra, which is a discourse otherwise without a Pali counterpart. This is, the Mahalla Sutra is one of the sutras from the Sanskrit Dirgha Agama, which has been recently recovered from, probably from Afghanistan, and which is belongs to the Sarvastivadin or Mullah Sarvastivadin school. And Mahalla Sutra being one of the few discourses in there that are not otherwise known from Pali. So the Mahalla Sutra offers an examination of the gratification, danger, and release or escape in relation to sensual pleasures similar to the Mahadukkha Kandha Sutta. It's an examination of the dangers of sensual pleasures. The Mahalla Sutra only speaks of the taking up of weapons in relation to quarrels that have risen among warriors and Brahmins, etc., whereas in relation to family members, it merely envisages verbal dispute. So, the agreement between the two Chinese versions and this otherwise unrelated Sanskrit fragment suggest that the Pali version's presentation could be the outcome of a transmission error where what originally were two passages, one concerned with kings, etc., and one with family members, came to form a single passage. Due to being combined in a single passage, the description of the family members may then have come to be part of the description of the type of quarrelling that at times take place among kings, etc. In fact, family ties appear to have been of considerable importance in ancient India, so that one would not expect the taking up of weapons and mutual killing among family members to be a common enough occurrence so as to serve as a typical example in the present context. So this is the difference between the Pali and the other ones here, the Pali saying that family members merely argue with each other, whereas the other one's saying that they also attack each other with knives and weapons. What do you think?
In the other places, it says, what do householders fight about?
Yeah.
Fight about sensual pleasures, and what do religious people fight about?
Yeah.
Fight about views.
Yeah.
So I guess that's what it's talking about here, is fighting about sensual pleasures, because that's what topic we're on.
Yeah. But is that just verbally arguing, or is that attacking each other with weapons?
Attacking with fists and gloves and knives.
Yeah, but is that just the Pali people? Maybe the Pali people were doing that. Maybe it's just an expression of the violence that was happening in the Mahavihara in Anuradhapura in Sri Lanka, where they were attacking each other. Any thoughts on that? I mean, it certainly immediately strikes me that these days, and we've probably all heard the statistics, that actually violence is much more common in the family than outside of it.
This was an issue that I was going to bring forward.
Yeah.
And maybe the idea. I mean, if we didn't know that as a fact, then we might think, even in this day and age, that family values prevent this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And now that we know it as a fact, I was actually going to raise as a question, how do we know it was a fact in those days?
Yeah.
I don't see the likelihood very much.
That it was?
That great a fact. I would think that the practice over time in India of inter-family violence is pretty well documented, and it's maybe an evasion of what actually did happen.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that if the new daughter-in-law doesn't seem to measure up to the son, the sari catches fire.
Yeah, right.
What about in the royal family? I mean,
what is it, King Ajat's? Yeah, this is mentioned, Analia mentions that here, yeah. And that seems to be alluded to in the previous paragraph, doesn't it? It says ungrateful heirs, yeah, specifically mentioned. I mean, I've just been actually reading about this very, very topic in this book that Alex gave me a while ago called The Origins of the Sacred, and just the very chapter I've just been reading now is a chapter talking about Cain and Abel. So in the Bible, it's not merely the fact that there happens to be violence among kin, but that the actual root violence, the first act of violence in humanity, is actually kinslaying, the slaying of one brother by another. And that's not a kind of an isolated occurrence. In Egyptian mythology, exactly the same thing happens with Seth and Osiris, also brothers, where Seth slays Osiris. And many, many other examples. In fact, if you look through mythologies, or the early mythologies, then constantly the root crimes, you look at Oedipus and Agamemnon and on and on, Tantalus, that there's slaying among family members. And this is just as much the case in Indian mythology as anywhere else, and particularly, I mean, just the most obvious example is the Mahabharata, which the whole plot of the Mahabharata is a war between the two groups of cousins who are very closely related and are fighting each other, and that's a kind of a massive war which is happening exactly as is described in the next paragraph, which we haven't reached yet.
Well, Bhante, you've got Mahamoggallana, who's supposed to have killed his parents.
Mahamoggallana killed his parents? Well, in previous lives?
Many previous times. And then you've got Devadatta, the Buddha, which is his cousin.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So I think it was pretty...
pretty common.
Obvious common as it is,
yeah. Yeah, many, many examples, yeah. And... go on.
That gets more mentioned than the other things, kings of kings, because then you've got amongst family members, there's a bigger list with amongst family members.
Yeah.
Then you've got kings of kings, nobles, nobles, but then you get to family.
Yeah.
Brother, brother, sister, brother.
Yeah, kind of long.
Brother.
Yeah, they keep on going, all the permutations.
Mama was going to go and kill his mother.
Yeah.
Would have stopped him.
Yeah. The other thing, Analo mentions here that because of kinship ties, were of considerable importance in ancient India, and of course Analo gives a reputable scholarly reference source here. But of course kinship ties are important everywhere in the world, and that the two things are not unrelated. In fact, they're probably extremely related. The very fact of development of kinship ties was probably to a large degree in order to control unwarranted acts of violence, also sex and violence among kin. Yeah, and so the basic taboos is the slaying of family members and also incest, and these are like the two great taboos. And so that's like the very structure of kinship ties, which are very complex and very widespread around the world, were developed in order to protect the family and the extended family and the tribe and so on from those kinds of things. And it's from that basis that we've extended our moral sphere of consideration. Like in the early days, you know, we worry about not killing our family member. Fine, that's considered to be a problem, but we don't care if we kill someone from another tribe. It means nothing to us. And it's only gradually that we learn to extend that kind of moral sphere
of concern. I'll tell you the prohibition that was in Buddhism: if you kill your parents, you can't become enlightened.
Right. Yeah.
Lifetimes, yeah. It must have been. I mean, if no one ever killed their parents, yeah, how would you even mention it?
Yeah.
Not even to mention Chinese culture. Filial piety.
Yeah. And yeah. Okay, so I think we're great. So that leaves a problem then, is that on text critical grounds, I think Analo is on very firm grounds here and thinking that probably the mention of violence among families doesn't seem to have been as central to the text, and yet in society, the practice of violence among families is, I think, extremely central. And so we're left in not quite... It raises then an interpretive issue as to why that may be the case. I don't necessarily have any answers to that. Although, given... If we're right in thinking that family violence is, in fact, very prevalent, then if it was not included in the original text, then that would have given a good reason for the Pali editors to have put it into their text. Okay, so the next paragraph. Again, with sensual pleasures as the cause, sensual pleasures as the reason and the source, men take swords and shields and buckle on bows and quivers, and they charge into battle, massed in double array, with arrows and spears flying and swords flashing. And there they're wounded by arrows and spears, and their heads are cut off by swords, whereby they incur death or deadly suffering. Now this too is a danger in the case of sensual pleasures. Again, with sensual pleasures as the cause, men take swords and shields and buckle on bows and quivers, and they charge slippery bastions with arrows and spears flying and swords flashing, and there they're wounded by arrows and spears and splashed with boiling liquids and crushed under heavy weights. So this, of course, is referring to like assaulting a castle or something like that, the bastion, where they're pouring boiling tar and so on your head from above. And their heads are cut off by swords, whereby they incur death or deadly suffering. This, too, is a danger in the case of sensual pleasures. Again, with sensual pleasures as the cause, men break into houses, plunder wealth, commit burglary, ambush highways, seduce others' wives, and when they are caught, kings have many kinds of torture inflicted upon them. The kings have them beaten, have them flogged with whips, beaten with canes, beaten with clubs. They have their hands cut off, their feet cut off, their hands and feet cut off, their ears cut off, their noses cut off, their ears and noses cut off. They have them subjected to the porridge pot. The polished shell shave, to the Rahu's mouth, to the fiery wreath, to the flaming hand, to the blades of grass, to the bark dress, to the antelope, to the meat hooks, to the coins, to the lye pickling, to the pivoting pin, and to the rolled up, how do you pronounce the word? Palias? What's a palias?
Like a mattress.
Like a mattress, a rolled up mattress.
Like in the
Bismo
just says
it,
but the commentary goes in.
Yeah, Bhikkhu Bodhi Wibbs out there. He doesn't tell what the things are, but the.
In the worst one, the coin.
Yeah, the coins one is where they cut off pieces of discs of flesh the size of a coin, one by one.
Isn't there the one where they take the top of your skull off and then sort of drop a hot rock on your brain or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Isn't that one of those?
And there's another one where they peel your skin off around like an orange. And they
rub hot gravel on your ears or something. Like
yeah.
Anthony.
Yeah.
I would like to raise up a point here that it hasn't been raised, but perhaps to all of us here, we don't have any experience of it. But those persons that rob and do all these violent actions, or even soldiers going to war, have a big buzz, a huge sensual pleasure in doing it.
Yeah, sure.
And that's the definite fruits of all this incredible sensual buzz.
Yeah.
Is if you get caught, well.
That's what happens.
One end of the spectrum got the other one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so I mean, I guess the fruits of sensual pleasures in that way is twofold. Is one is that you do it because you expect to get something out of it, like you rob something because you just expect to get the whatever you're trying to rob, but also more directly is the actual buzz of the thrill of it doing it. Yeah.
Then you get like the return soldiers, veterans, they like have post-traumatic stress.
Afterwards, yeah.
It's up and down.
In our day and age, yeah.
It's up and down, big time.
Again, the book I was just reading about talk about this in regard to chimpanzee behaviour, and also the chimps get a very, very strong kind of bloodlust when they're attacking or killing prey or something like that. And, they really get off on it. So, yeah. It's a huge, huge thrill.
So maybe most people here don't appreciate that's something that's on.
Yeah.
It does exist and it is a sensual pleasure of high order.
Yeah, I mean we tend to transmute it into things like boxing and wrestling and all of these kinds of stuff where people really get off on it.
Football.
Well, it's like the war frenzy that most of the West got into when America was going to invade Iraq to beat themselves up into a frenzy.
Yeah.
It became like a big media event.
Yeah.
And now it's worn off.
Yeah.
All the suffering's coming in.
Yeah.
But I mean, they totally lost. I mean, all the people
that supported
the war in America now they're all coming out and saying, what did we do?
Yeah. Yeah.
The reality set in.
So yes, the commentary gives great detail about each one of those tortures. It has been translated or summarized somewhere. I can't remember exactly where. If you are interested in knowing all the details of ancient Indian torture techniques, and they have them splashed with boiling oil, and they have them thrown to be devoured by dogs, and they have them impaled alive on stakes, and they have their heads cut off with swords, whereby they, not surprisingly, incur death or deadly suffering. Now, this too is a danger in the case of sensual pleasures. So, obviously, means of punishment in those days were pretty strict, which is kind of interesting because in our community we discuss the vinaya and so on quite a lot, and it's quite remarkable, even more remarkable, we see the gentleness and humanity and compassion in the Vinaya, in the way that punishment and so on is treated there, in comparison with what was the prevailing standard at the time, is quite remarkable. Again, with sensual pleasures as the cause, sensual pleasures as the basis, the cause being simply sensual pleasures, people indulge in misconduct of body, speech and mind. Having done so, in the dissolution of the body after death, they reappear in states of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Now this too is a danger in the case of sensual pleasures, a mass of suffering in the life to come. Okay, so here I've gone too far back. Oh, I can go backwards. In the life to come. So here is the word here, samparayiko, I referred to earlier. So we have the difference here is the sandiptiko, the mass of suffering present in this life, in this very life, sandiptiko. And then in the future life, samparayiko. So this is the one that's changed. Okay, so this is the different kinds of suffering I may experience in this lifetime and lifetime in the future. And you can see that the overall structure of that whole passage, it starts out with relatively benign forms of suffering, you know, gadflies and so on, and then goes up through arguments and then to, you know, violence and then to war and then torture. It gets getting worse and worse, and so the suffering experienced in the future lives would seem to be even greater than those horrible kinds of tortures and so on which one might experience in this life. Okay, and what bhikkhus is the escape in the case of and just to notice one interesting difference there previously, that whereas the Pali in that previous passage just talks about indulging in misconduct of body, speech and mind and then going to a bad destiny after this in the afterlife, the Madhyama Agama version and the individual translation also mention the worry and regret experienced by such an evil doer as a danger visible in the present life. So bad ethics leads to suffering both in this lifetime and the next. And what bhikkhus is the escape in the case of sensual pleasures? It is the removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for sensual pleasures. This is the escape in the case of sensual pleasures. Bodhi's not here. Okay, so that those recluses and Brahmins who do not understand as it actually is, the gratification as gratification, the danger and the danger as the escape, and the escape as escape in the case of sensual pleasures, can either themselves fully understand sensual pleasures or instruct another so that he can fully understand sensual pleasures, that is impossible. That those recluses and Brahmins who understand as it actually is, the gratification as gratification, the danger as danger, and the escape as escape in the case of sensual pleasures, can either themselves fully understand sensual pleasures or instruct another so that he can fully understand sensual pleasures, that is possible. Okay, so this being quite a complex sentence structure here in Pali, this kind of classic phrase which you will become accustomed to in our chanting, netang tanang vidyati, not that possible is. Okay, that is not possible. Tanam etang vidyati is the opposite, that is possible. That phrase, when we say tanam etam vidyati, it has a slightly stronger positive sense in the Pali than the word it is possible means in English. When you say in English, we say it's possible, well, you just mean, well, it's kind of logically, it can happen. Okay, but when we say it is possible in this sense in Pali, it means more like, well, that's what's going to happen, or that, you know, you almost like you can do it. Yeah, you can. It's like can do. Okay, so. And notice the idiomatic grammar here, asadanacha asadato. This is an ablative form where it says, no, understand the gratification as gratification. The phrase where we translate in English as gratification here is represented in Pali by the ablative form asadato, adinavancha adinavato, nisaranancha nisaranato. Okay. So, Next one. Material form. And what... So in, I haven't mentioned all the time, but in all of these, the Pali and Chinese versions are very similar in all the respects so far, as indeed in the next session there's no substantial difference between the Pali and the Chinese versions. And what bhikkhus is the gratification in the case of material form? Suppose there were a girl of the noble class, or of the Brahmin class, or of the householder stock in her 15th or 16th year, neither too tall nor too short, neither too thin nor too fat, neither too dark nor too fair. Is her beauty and loveliness then at its height? Yes, Venerable Sir. Now, the pleasure and joy that arise in dependence on that beauty and loveliness are the gratification in the case of material form. And what bhikkhus is the danger in the case of material form? Later on, one might see that same woman here as 80, 90 or 100 years, aged, as crooked as a roof bracket, doubled up, supported. And you do actually, you really literally see that if you go to India, see these little old women, they're literally doubled up. They're literally, when their posture's like that, their shoulders are literally lower than their hips as they're walking around the place in some places. It's quite amazing. Doubled up, supported by a walking stick, tottering, frail, her youth gone, her teeth broken, grey-haired, scanty-haired, bald, wrinkled, with limbs all blotchy. What do you think, bhikkhus? Has her former beauty and loveliness vanished and the danger become evident? Yes, Venerable Sir, bhikkhus, this is a danger in the case of material form. Again, one might see that same woman, afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill, lying fouled in her own excrement and urine, lifted up by some and set down by others. What do you think, bhikkhus? Has her former beauty and loveliness vanished and the danger become evident? Yes, Venerable Sir, bhikkhus, this too is a danger in the case of material form. Again, one might see that same woman as a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, 1, 2, or 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and oozing matter. What do you think? So here the Pali words, thrown aside in the charnel ground, 1, 2, or 3 days, udhumatakang. We translate this in the, or it was in the Satipatthana Sutta, bloated, livid, vinilakang. Nila being blue or bluish green, and vinila, v here having the connotation of wrong. Yeah, so v is just like a kind of rotten blue colour, we translate as. Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as livid, I think. Yeah, livid. And vipubhaka. Pubha is pus. Pubhaka, vipubhaka. Again, vi having the notion of wrongness. So kind of rotten, wrong or rotting pus. Vipubhaka jata. Jata is kind of born. So like sprouting out rotten pus. So the Pali, in the language in this particular sutra is very vivid. What do you think, bhikkhus? Has her former beauty and loveliness vanished and the danger become evident? Yes, Venerable Sir, bhikkhus, this too is a danger in the case of material form. So, of course, these being the same as the charnel ground contemplations in the Satipatthana Sutta. Again, one might see that the same woman as a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, being devoured by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, and various kinds of worms. So here's the different names for the different animals. Kaka is a name for a crow, of course being a very obvious name for a crow. Kaka! So there's the kaka, and the crows, hawks. Gijha is the vulture, as in Gijakuta, the vulture's pig. Dogs. Kanka. Sunakehi, jackals. Byagha, various kinds of worms. Oh, seems to have some extra ones in there. Byagha is a, those jackals, vultures. The Pali text has some extra ones that are not in the, one we have. Byagha is a tiger, I think. Byagha. DP here, I'm not sure what DP is. So, a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews, a fleshless skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinews, disconnected bones scattered in all directions, here a hand bone, there a foot bone, there, here a thigh bone, there a rib bone, here a hip bone, here there a backbone, here the skull. So what this means is the hip bone, the hand bone is not connected to the thigh bone, the foot bone is not connected to them. Bones bleached white, the colour of shells, bones heaped up more than a year old, bones rotted and crumbled to dust. What do you think? Because has her former beauty and loveliness vanished and the danger become evident? Yes, Venerable Sir, because this too is a danger in the case of material form. And what bhikkhus is the escape in regarding in material form? It is the removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for material form. That is the escape in the case of material form. That those recluses and Brahmins who do not understand as it actually is, the gratification as gratification, the danger as danger, and the escape as escape, in the case of material form, can either themselves fully understand material form or instruct another so that he can fully understand material form. That is impossible. That those recluses and Brahmins who understand as it actually is, the gratification as gratification, the danger as danger, and the escape as escape, in the case of material form, can either themselves fully understand material form or instruct another so that he can fully understand material form. That is possible. So, I guess the in this case, you know, has chosen as the example is of a girl, and not of a girl or boy, as it sometimes gives. And so, in isolation, I guess if you took this particular passage in isolation, it would you know, give the impression that it's kind of an objectification, where women are seen as the object of beauty and the object of desire. And there's probably some truth to that within the Pali scriptures, that they do tend to emphasize seeing the woman as the object in that way. However, also remember that these when we look at these particular passages, the old woman, so the sick woman and the dead woman, these of course are the three signs that the Bodhisattva was supposed to have seen when he went out from the home, except of course in that case it was usually a man who did that. And in the kind of the mythic construct that's built around that particular thing is that the signs are actually devadutas, they are messengers from the gods. So it's not the fact that somebody is being contemplated in this way is not necessarily a sign that they are themselves being disparaged or criticized or put down in any way. On the contrary, it's actually felt, again according to the tradition, that the being who does that in that myth of the Bodhisattva going forth is actually a deva from the pure abodes, who's one of the most pure and exalted of all beings in all of samsara. Is an anagami from the pure abodes who's come down specially in order to manifest in terms of these signs. So it's certainly not the case that within the Buddhist tradition that you know, being the object of this kind of description was felt, was meant to be in a way that was somehow disparaging or negative, and particularly negative for women in particular.
And then there's the sutras of the Anguttara Nikaya, mm-hmm. has it in both,
yeah? Swaps it around for men and women back and front, yeah?
And they all have a form which writes obsessing the mind or something, then that's the form of woman, then it goes the opposite, then
yeah.
For a woman, that of a man.
Yeah, and so I think that can be taken as a general principle in the suttas, that you can swap them around. It's not always done. So they tend to be taken from the male perspective or from a stereotype male perspective. But in principle, then they can always be swapped around and seen from both perspectives. Okay? Okay. And what, bhikkhus, is the gratification in the case of feelings? Here, bhikkhus, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, and bhikkhus, or unwholesome dhammas, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by initial and sustained application of mind, vitaka vichara, and with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Of course, being the basic formula for the first jhana, viviceva kamehi. And so notice, of course, this being having a quite a strong implication in the current sutta. We've just been talking about all the dangers in karma, in sensual pleasures, and of course the bhikkhu, the jhana formula starting out, viviceva kamehi, quite secluded from kamehi, from sensual pleasures, viviceva akusalehi dhamehi, from unwholesome dhammas with vitaka, with vichara, vivekajang, seclusion. Ja here is born, so born of seclusion, piti, rapture and bliss, the rapture and bliss born of seclusion. Patamang jhanang upasampadja viharati. Patamang is the first, jhana is a jhana. One enters and abides in the first jhana. On such an occasion, he does not choose for his own affliction or for another's affliction or for the affliction of both. On that occasion, he feels only feeling that is free from affliction. The highest gratification in the case of feelings is freedom from affliction, I say. So here the Buddha praising the feeling in jhana is not causing any harm to oneself or any others. Again, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, vitaka vicharana, punachaparang bhikkhave, punachaparang, this is just a, means, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates it as again, puna means beyond, or no, puna means again, cha means and, parang means beyond, so we have this kind of idiom, it just means and again, bhikkhus. Bhikkhu vitaka vicharanang, again vitaka, initial sustained application. Vrupasama is the stilling or the appeasing. Here having the grammatical function of saying due to the appeasing of vitaka and vichara, internally sampasada is, how did Bhikkhu Bodhi translate it? What's it, you know what normal Bhikkhu Bodhi translation of that is? Sampasada, it's like means either clarity or faith. Confidence, I think, internal confidence, he probably translates it as.
Yeah, internal confidence.
Internal confidence, yeah. Internal confidence, but also means clarity, clarity of mind. Chetaso eko di bhavang, of the heart, eko di bhavang, having the state of oneness, having the state of oneness in the heart. Avitakang, without vitaka, without vichara. Samadhi jang. So born of samadhi, piti sukhang, that rapture and bliss, piti sukha, born of samadhi, enters and abides in the second jhana. And then of course, asking samaya bhikkhu, piti acha viraga, with due to the fading away of rapture, okay, viraga, again the long A at the end here is an ablative ending, meaning due to, in this case, meaning due to the fading away of rapture. Upekako cha viharati, here one abides with equanimity, mindful and clearly comprehending. And so notice that, of course, in certain popular expositions of Buddhist meditation, there's like a contrast or almost like a war between mindfulness and samadhi, but actually it's here in the jhana formula that we find the consciousness with is supposed to have purified mindfulness. Sato cha sampajana, mindfulness clearly comprehending and experiencing sukha, experiencing bliss with the body. So it's experiencing bliss with the body. Yantang Arya Achikanti, that which the Aryas, the noble ones, declare equanimous and mindful, one dwells in bliss, sukha vihari, vihari dwelling in sukha, in bliss. Tatyang jhanang upasampadja viharati, one enters and abides in the third jhana. So here the word equanimity here, referring to the equanimity of one's attitude. Okay? So one still is experiencing pleasant feeling, but one has an equanimous attitude, a very even-minded attitude towards that pleasant feeling. So your like emotional response to the pleasant feeling is more mature in the previous jhanas, first and second jhana, then your emotional response to the pleasant feeling was the response of piti or rapture, which is a slight sense of thrill or uplift or excitement about the pleasant feeling. And in the third jhana, your emotional response is upekha, is just even. You're still feeling it, but very, very equanimous about it. And then to the fourth jhana, sukhasa cha pahana, due to the, again, notice that long A, the end there is the ablative ending, pahana, the abandoning of pleasure, the abandoning of suffering, dukkha. Pubbeva somanasa domanasa nangatangama, and due to the ending of previous mental pleasure and pain. Dukkhama sukhang, without pleasure, without pain, without pleasure. So it's really emphasizing, it says it three times, getting rid of pain and pleasure. Upekha, again, equanimity. Sati, mindfulness. Parisuddhin is the purity. This particular compound, when words are phrased in a compound like this in Pali, it's not there are a number of different ways in which one can construe the relationship between the elements in the compound. So here it could mean, for example, you have purity of equanimity and mindfulness, okay? But it's usually translated, I think, following a commentarial gloss as having you have purity of mindfulness through equanimity, okay? So because of your equanimity, your mindfulness is purified. Chatuttham jhanam upasampadya viharati. So one enters and abides in the fourth jhana, chatuttham, fourth jhana upasampadya, enters and abides. So on that occasion, one does not atabhyabadha atta oneself, one does not intend, cheteti is a verb form of jetana or volition, and one does not have volition for the affliction for others, para, or not for both, ubhaya. So this is the highest gratification in the case of feelings is freedom from affliction, I say.
Ante, the reference there to mindfulness.
Yeah.
And then you have the Muslim people saying that you can't have mindfulness in jhana because you're absorbed into the object.
Mm.
So it doesn't come in from.
Doesn't make sense, yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. The actual case, I mean, from the suttas, is that the word mindfulness is almost never used in the context of vipassana. Actually, so if you looked in the great collections of suttas which deal with vipassana practice directly, like in the Khanda Sanyutta, Salayatana Sanyutta, and places like that, where there are hundreds of suttas telling you, you know, contemplate anicca dukkha anatta regarding the five khandhas, contemplate anicca dukkha anatta regarding the six senses, and these things are taught again and again and again and again. In those places, it never uses the word mindfulness to describe that contemplation. So the whole association of mindfulness as such with vipassana is entirely a product of the... its only foundation is in one sutta, of course, the Satipatthana Sutta, in the Pali version. That's the only place where it says, where they're actually associated.
So it's, you can say that the way they're using mindfulness is not in accordance with
the
description and the sort of what is meant by mindfulness.
Yeah.
I mean, if your relation to the jhanas of mindfulness there would be meaning total absorption into your meditation object.
Right, right.
So your whole mind is on it, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Your mind is full of it.
Yeah, so you're not mindful moment to moment of what is arising and ceasing as...
Yeah. Yeah, see, in the Pali would use other words to describe that. You know, it would usually use pajanati or samanupasati or something like that to contemplate or to understand or to observe or different words. But the actual word sati is not used in those contexts at all.
About the way Ajahn Sumedho, he's always talking about to reflect.
Yeah. To reflect is interesting. I mean, that more literally, there's Pali idioms like Pachavekati, which literally to reflect. But the way Ajahn Sumedho talks about it is quite interesting. I'm not really sure, actually. But I know at one time one of the monks told me that he got frustrated with the monks in the monastery one time, and he said, you know, you guys, you just don't know how to reflect. So you're like, what's going on? It's just always so hard to communicate these ideas. Like, what are you actually doing when you're reflecting on something? We can use the word, we've got an idea, we've got an intuitive idea of what that means, but what actually are you doing? It's very hard to determine. So, I mean, that's why I think there is a lot of disparity in how people are using meditation words. I mean, it's not, there's good reasons for it. It's very hard to know what you're actually doing or what someone's doing when they're sitting down and meditating. It's very hard to know that, and it's very hard to know whether one person says my mind becomes peaceful and another person says my mind becomes peaceful, or one person says I'm reflecting, another person says I'm reflecting. Well, what are they actually doing or what's happening? It's extremely hard to know and to compare these things. So this is why I think, you know, at the very least we can, you know, we can, if we're looking at the scriptures, then we can get an idea of, well, how are they using words in a particular context. So that's helpful as a starting place, but it doesn't really solve the actual problem, which is really a problem of communication. How do we communicate inner mental states in a useful way to people? And this is why you get in the forest tradition, you know, all the different forest teachers will develop their own very idiosyncratic terminologies to try to describe these things, you know, and they try to talk about it in a way that someone will understand, that can actually help them. They're not so much interested in like theoretical correctness or anything, but in actually, how can I communicate to this person here to try to help them to find peace of mind? James?
There's a repetition here of the word affliction.
Mm-hmm.
Open that a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think affliction here is really the literal... the literal meaning of it is disease. Abhyapada, here's the word, abhyapada, abhyapada. It means disease. It's also close in meaning to ill will or anger. So it can be used in both of those contexts more specifically. But here it's really just a synonym for suffering. Yeah, but a bit less... not quite as potent as if we were to say suffering. Vyapada is, it just means suffering, but it means suffering in a bit more of a slightly more coarse form. It doesn't have the same existential dimension as suffering does. So in the next paragraph we're about to realize, well, even these things are impermanent and so on. So even though there's no actual affliction going on in terms of actual arisen suffering, but still they are dukkha within the broader meaning of the term dukkha. Does that help?
Probably does.
Okay. And what bhikkhus is the... So it's of course very interesting and very striking that the sutta chooses to exemplify feelings by talking about the four jhanas. And this is quite common in suttas, quite characteristic that jhanas are very closely associated with feelings. And we notice certain similarities between this sutta and the Satipatthana Sutta in the treatment of the charnel ground meditations and so on. And that's in the Ekhotara Agama version, that is to say the Mahasanghika version, according to Venerable Analia, differs considerably from the other version since it expounds the gratification in relation to feeling with the example of the practice of mindfulness of feeling, described in the same way as the treatment of this Satipatthana given in the parallel within the same collection. The subsequent passage on the danger of feeling in the same sutta, however, has no formal introduction, unlike all similar instances in this sutta, but instead it begins with the conjunction again, the equivalent of punachaparang, even though it treats a different topic. This suggests that an error in textual transmission has occurred, all the more probable since contemplation of feeling does not fit the present context. So notice again Analio's methodology here. He wants to, and notice how he's very cautious in the way that he goes about things. And sometimes he discusses it and say, oh, you know, it's possible this or possible that. Now here he's much more confident. It suggests that an error has occurred, all the more probable. So notice a kind of degree of confidence, and based on three things. One is the fact that there's only one aberrant version and all the other versions are in line. The second thing is that the formal conjunction word is different, is wrong. So what he's saying is that here, where we don't find the punachaparang we found in the previous ones, okay, we notice here we have a punachaparang. This is linking up the paragraphs or the sections within one question or one paragraph. It like links up from one to the other punachaparang. Whereas the Chinese version that we're talking about has another punachaparang or equivalent here, where we wouldn't expect one. So this is the second factor, and the third factor is he feels that in terms of the treatment of the subject matter is not as appropriate for the context. So those three things taken together enable us to have a certain degree of confidence in thinking that the Yogotra Agama version in this case is perhaps due to a textual flaw. And in particular, that little detail about the Punicha Parang is quite telling. These are exactly the kind of little editing problems which we very regularly find when bits have been cut and pasted from other suttas or other passages. Okay, so this is the gratification in the case of feelings. And what, bhikkhus, is the danger in the case of feelings? Feelings are impermanent, suffering, and subject to change. This is the danger in the case of feelings. So, of course, interesting, it doesn't say not self here, but impermanence, and they are suffering. And what, bhikkhus, is the escape in the case of feelings? It is the removal of desire and lust, the abandonment of desire and lust for feelings. This is the escape in the case of feelings. And that those recluses and Brahmins who do not understand as it actually is, the gratification as gratification, the danger as danger, and the escape as escape in the case of feelings, can either themselves fully understand feelings or instruct another so that he can fully understand feelings. That is impossible. That those recluses and Brahmins who understand as it actually is, the gratification as gratification, the danger as danger, and the escape as escape in the case of feelings, can either themselves fully understand feelings or instruct another so that he can fully understand feelings. That is possible. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's world. And the Yogotra Agama version also has the Buddha's exhortation to meditate and not be negligent, lest one should regret it. So, yeah, go on.
That's not to say that feelings are self, though.
That's not to say that feelings are self. No, it just doesn't mention the contemplation of not self, because it's, I guess, because it's the it's quite precise actually, because it's the sutra is because it's the Mahadukkha Kanda Sutta, so it's the subject of the sutra itself is suffering, so it mentions suffering, but the suffering within pleasant feelings, especially feelings of jhana, the suffering in them is not the intrinsic suffering, but suffering with them is called the suffering of change. So those two are quite it's quite precisely chosen for the context there. Yeah. So this kind of contemplation, this kind of sutra, is obviously quite an intense discourse. And we're finding some extremely vivid language there, and very quite powerful and quite challenging passages there. Some things we're not likely to forget very quickly. And so this being very useful for somebody who wants to really use dukkha as their particular avenue or mode of developing insight, then this sutra is appropriate for those people. And what you tend to find is that you know, of course, anyone who develops insight will see anicca, dukkha, and anatta. But different people will tend to emphasize or relate to one or other of those characteristics more. So, in modern times, of course, Ajahn Chah was very well known for his saying, "My Nair, it's not certain, it's impermanent," and so that was really his main focus. Ajahn Buddhadasa, on the other hand, really focused strongly on not self was his like chief or most characteristic avenue that he used for his Dhamma explorations. For suffering, if I try to think of an example of who would choose suffering as their main way of developing insight, perhaps Ajahn Mahabua be characterized in that way, but also perhaps Ajahn Brahm also. Which is kind of interesting, because when you listen to Ajahn Brahm's talks, he's always talking about happiness. It's always happiness, 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 right? And it's always, you know, be happy, get into jhanas and have a good time and stuff. But when he does talk about insight, then he talks very powerfully about suffering, and you can see that he, because of his happiness, because of his confidence in his own happiness, his own psychological happiness, he's quite happy to face up to the reality of suffering. It doesn't faze him, And I remember one memorable talk where he said, you know, some people, they try to translate suffering as unsatisfactoriness. He says, ah, what a load of rubbish. Suffering, suffering, suffering. That's what it means. Dukkha is just suffering, suffering. And because he's, when your mind, somebody who emphasizes the samadhi a lot, and they've emphasized that happiness of the mind, that's when they're able to see that contrast and see the suffering. And that, I think, is precisely why the sutta has ended up with presenting the four jhanas as being the avenue for developing insight. Because somebody who's developed that, they see that feeling, that pleasant feeling, they have both the psychological stability and breadth and openness and wholeness to be able to look at suffering very clearly and very directly, and also they can see it more, they can see the contrast, because you've seen what it means to be free of suffering, and then all that pain and that suffering just becomes so much more powerful to you, more vivid. Okay, any more questions, comments?
I think in this particular, sort of just going on from what you said there, you used the word completeness and wholeness, but also the sutta refers often to fully understanding, you know, the three characteristics. And I think that's helpful, that, you know, the whole package that encompasses dukkha is presented, knowing, honouring that there is an element of pleasure and joy, and that's obviously within gratification is gratification, you know, acknowledging that, not totally crushing it and saying, no, you know, assume until the mind lets go. If you reflect and say, okay, there is an element of pleasure and joy, but then you weigh that up with looking at the danger is the danger, seeing the pitfalls, seeing the shortcomings, seeing the dangers, saying there's no security in any pleasure or joy that may appear on offer, that is on offer through the sensory realm, by getting the two sides of the coin, I think it's complete and it's whole, and therefore maybe, you know, the mind will be more inclined to reach the escape section. It has all the facts and it can actually make a comprehensive evaluation itself. And I think when it has the facts, the mind can be more inclined to let go.
Absolutely, yeah. Yep. And that's really the what is that, the genius of that particular group of those three contemplations, Asada, Adinawa and Nisarana. And you know, so this is what the point the Buddha was making at the beginning, that you can kind of know these things, but, you know, do you have what they call parinya, it's like the full knowing, all-round knowing. To know those three things is like the all-round knowing. Yeah.
And what about the removal of the desire and lust? It usually just gets one paragraph, whereas the suffering gets a whole.
Suffering. Well, that's the nisarana in that particular formulation, that the nisarana is the escape. It encompasses both the third and the fourth noble truths. Yeah. So its kind of higher meaning is the third noble truth of Nibbana, but also, of course, encompassing the way of practice leading to Nibbana, of course, being the Eightfold Path. Yeah, so this particular sutta as such is, of course, mainly focusing on the first noble truth. Yeah. Okay, so let's finish by paying respects.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivāde svākhāto bhagavata rammo namannamassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho Sangham Nam.